From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made back in March, in the first days of the pandemic. Government leaders urged renters in particular to ask their landlords for a break. After all, thousands of people were told to stay home from work, and paychecks stopped coming for many. Almost immediately, tenants' rights advocates called for moratoriums on evictions, along with support for renters. Some also called for a hard stop on mortgage payments, considering the ripple effect of renters being in trouble. But there was no singular government policy across the country. It's been a patchwork approach, and advocates are sounding an ominous alarm now. A real crisis is in front of us. Within weeks, we could see a wave of evictions in Rochester and Western New York and really across this country. Renters are not only struggling with the pandemic, many were struggling before the spread of the coronavirus. And the additional federal support of $600 per week recently ran out. It's not clear if Congress is going to extend it or modify it. So what happens when landlords tell renters that the time for breaks is over? What happens to landlords who can't pay their own mortgages? What happens for renters who feel trapped in this crisis and face homelessness or eviction? As City Newspaper recently reported, Rochester City Council is showing support for a plan to offer free legal representation for residents facing eviction. City's Gino Finelli reports, quote, "Tenants have mostly been protected from eviction since the outset of the health crisis, first by a statewide moratorium on evictions, and now by the broader state Tenant Safe Harbor Act, which protects qualifying tenants from being evicted for non-payment of rent between early March and the full reopening of their country, of their county, I should say. But tenants grappling with eviction notices from prior to the outbreak or for reasons other than non-payment of rent remain vulnerable. And the law does not prohibit landlords from filing for eviction and seeking money judgments to recuperate missed rent payments," end quote. So what happens next? What happens to the economy if thousands of people are suddenly evicted? What happens to them? What recourse do they have in this moment? Not every case is really easy. I mean, these are very complex situations at times. And sometimes even police don't know what to do when they're called in for these kind of disputes. So let's talk about it. Our guests this hour are working on these kinds of issues. Mark Moyo is Program Director of the Housing and Consumer Law Unit, the Legal Aid Society of Rochester, New York. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Evan, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Alex Turner, an eviction prevention representative to the Homeless Services Network and Community Resource Services Program Director at Catholic Family Center. Alex, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Tina Foster is Executive Director of the Volunteer Legal Services Project of Monroe County, Inc. Tina, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And welcome to Emily Benfer, who is a visiting associate clinical professor of law at Columbia Law School. Emily, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Emily, I want to start with you, and I want to quote from a piece that you wrote recently for NBCNews.com under the following headline: "Coronavirus rent freezes are ending and a wave of evictions will sweep America." You wrote, quote, "It's estimated that anywhere from 20 million to 28 million American renters are perilously close to eviction. The truth is the nation is failing them, and not for the first time. Even before COVID-19 struck, America faced its worst housing crisis in a century. According to Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies, 20.5 million families already struggled to scrape the rent together, and only one in four eligible renter households received financial assistance. Between the scarcity of federal housing support and the loss of 4 million affordable housing units over the last decade, it's no wonder renters are increasingly vulnerable to eviction. According to the Eviction Lab at Princeton University, 4 evictions were filed every minute in 2016 when the national unemployment rate was 4.7%. Today, unemployment is 3 times that level," end quote. And this was about a month ago when you wrote the piece. I mean, certainly those numbers of unemployment have gone up since then. So I want to ask you, Emily, I mean, just looking at the national landscape, sometimes we see these prognostications about a crisis or a wave of this or that, and it sort of looks a little bit like collective hypochondria. But in this case, you seem to be saying this is real and this is coming if nothing happens. I mean, how serious do you view this?
The level of housing precarity that we're seeing in the country is unprecedented. Our country has never faced this type of emergency in the past as it relates to risk of eviction. In fact, the numbers are much more grave, and it's a dire prediction that today it is estimated based on U.S. Census data that 30 to 40 million adults and children are at risk of eviction by the end of the year.
And researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, Turner Center for Housing Innovation estimate that 50 million renters live in households that suffered COVID-19-related job or income loss, with almost 40% occurring in low-income households. And, you know, Emily, it would be easy to look at this and say, well, this is a pandemic problem. This is a problem since March. But as our guests are going to talk about, this has exacerbated greatly what was already bubbling. How much do you think, you know, Americans who aren't in this crisis maybe don't realize the level of inequality and the level of sort of on the edge of crisis in terms of housing that many people were in even before the pandemic?
It may be widely overlooked, but I think today we can't deny the fact that we are on the verge of the most significant housing crisis in over a century. To put this in perspective, in just a few months, we could see four times the number of people displaced from their homes in the Great Depression. Only about 10 million people were displaced from their homes in the years following the Depression. And right now we're looking at four times that level, around 40 million people. But we did enter this situation in an affordable housing crisis, that we had wages that didn't track with the increasing rate of rent across the country. And we only had about one in four people who were eligible for federal financial assistance receiving it. So renters month to month were stretched threadbare and really unable to make that rent. And as a result, did not have the financial cushion to weather this emergency. And it's falling largely on people of color.
We're going to talk about what is being done at the local level and what sort of recourse there is for people who are, you know, facing this kind of crisis. I want to ask all of our guests to kind of share their thoughts about how they see this unfolding right now. Alex Turner, how do you see it?
So we can talk about the numbers locally, and they really do map to the national numbers. In Monroe County, there's 100,000 renting households. We believe that 15 or even 30,000 of them are behind either a month or more. But what we're seeing is it's a much wider range of experiences. These are families that were working, then they lost their job, and they're waiting 6 or even 8 weeks to hear back from unemployment about those benefits. And so during all that time, they're floating all of their bills, using up their savings to try to make that work. We're seeing other folks that were working and lost hours, and they were ineligible for those unemployment benefits. And those folks are also getting behind and facing the possibility of eviction. And then there's just the folks that were on fixed incomes and with new expenses. So we talked with grandmothers that are newly watching their kids because they're home from school or they're home from programs that are closed. And they're also facing getting behind because of all those new expenses, watching those children so that they're watching their grandchildren so that their own children can go to work and continue to pay bills. There's all of these new realities that are popping up for people and folks who are normally stable that are now really falling behind. And for each one of those stories, it's multiplied by 100 or 1,000 into these numbers that we're seeing. Just to get the empathy around those 10,000, 20,000, it's so hard to connect with that. But when you think about each of those individual stories multiplied hundreds of times, it's really a big crisis.
Mark Moyo, what are you seeing?
So at the Legal Aid Society, we're getting phone calls of people who are, falling behind on the rent, who are afraid of what could happen, who are, trying to figure out the best way to make the rent or to pay the rest of their bills. And so we're getting a lot of those phone calls. And the moratoria that have been put out by the governor, the court system, have been helpful in that way in terms of preventing, catastrophe at this point. And the Safe Harbor Act, I think, has some positive benefits in it. But, my experience goes back more than a decade. And, yes, as Emily pointed out, that a lot of people were already in terrible crisis before this happened. And this is just going to, unfortunately, bring a whole nother cohort of people into that crisis level. The dockets were already full at landlord-tenant court 5 days a week before this hit in March. So I can only imagine how many cases are going to be filed. And the Safe Harbor Act is important and I think a good piece of legislation, but it's not perfect in that a person does need to state their defense and prove it. So if they if they can't show up to court or if they don't get their paperwork or if they can't prove it, in some of those cases that Alex pointed out, then they might not be protected by the Safe Harbor Act. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of activity, but there was already a crisis on our hands before that.
Hmm. Tina Foster, what are you seeing?
I think that this issue is one that is, is absolutely a crisis. I agree with every speaker, what everyone said. I do think that we are seeing a disparate impact in communities of color. The same zip codes which are going to be most impacted are the same zip codes that are disproportionately people of color. They're disproportionately households, single female heads of households with children in them. You are looking at a massive impact on these communities. So you have a triple whammy of COVID, housing insecurity, already increased racial tensions. And as I think that we're going to talk about in the program as well, the lack of respect for the policies and the law that have been put in place to protect people and the enforcement of the law is really a lot of what this comes down to. The legal system only works for you if you have access to it. The Safe Harbor Act only works for you if you have a lawyer that can prove that case. The moratorium on evictions only works if the police enforce that law. And so I think there's a lot. The good news is there's a lot of people working, city government, the Justice for All initiative through the court system, the county. All of us have been working, I think, very hard on this issue. The good news is that Monroe County might actually be ahead in some respects in terms of our response to the crisis. So while I agree with what everyone said, I think we have a massive crisis. It was terrible before, but we also have an opportunity here to make some real change.
Well, and so in just a moment, we're going to work through what change might look like and what we're actually seeing happening. And we're also going to ask Tina, among our guests, to explain essentially what your rights are and how the eviction process works, what that actual process entails, sort of step by step, more than just, I think a lot of people think, well, you don't pay your rent, you can get evicted. We're going to talk about what it actually means. But I want to return to a point that Emily Benfer was making in her piece for NBCNews.com. When you say, in your view, the nation is failing 20 to 28 million American renters who are perilously close to eviction. There are listeners who I would hope will have empathy for people in hard times. But there will also be listeners who think, it's your responsibility to pay your rent, that to prepare for hard times, and that they might make the argument that the nation isn't failing them, that many people, maybe not all, but many people have failed on their own. How do you see the nation failing the people who are facing this eviction crisis?
In a pandemic setting where the economy has nosedived and there is no relief in sight, the only actor that can really help cities and states, local governments, respond to the eviction crisis is the federal government. And the federal government is at a stalemate. We have seen numerous federal bills that would provide the rental assistance necessary to keep people housed and to sustain property owners pass the House and not go anywhere in the Senate. So this is truly a failing of the federal government, and we need that rental assistance to be infused into local communities as quickly as possible. One part of this that we have to recognize is that when the eviction starts, when that process starts, when the rent is not paid, small property owners are in financial peril. More than half of those property owners, about 58%, lack access to credit to cover emergencies like lost rent payments. So they're at high risk of bankruptcy, of foreclosure. And when they're foreclosed upon, those properties are most likely to be sold less than market rate. It may lead to blight in that community. And we know that Monroe County and much of New York has a large small property owner rental market. And so this will have a great impact in the state if we don't start to see those federal funds come through quickly to really sustain the housing market. And also to mention that when the rent isn't paid, property taxes aren't paid, which means that our school budgets, our local infrastructure, and our state and local governments will not have the funds that they need to keep afloat during the pandemic.
Okay. Well, you know, let me turn locally, Alex Turner, to the point about that ripple effect that Emily Benfer is talking about there. Every time we talk about this kind of issue, we get phone calls and emails from property owners, from landlords, who implore me not to villainize landlords. And they say, don't villainize us. We are in a very hard spot, especially now. Renters often can't pay. We're not getting a break, you know, from the bank. We have to figure out how to make a mortgage work. You know, nobody wants to be in this situation. How do you, and I know every situation is different, and I'm sure Mark, Tina have seen it all. How do you view, you know, those kind of pleas that we tend to get when we're trying to kind of paint the picture of what's actually happening and landlords are saying, don't villainize us, Alex?
Yeah, absolutely. That point is something that I try to bring up in every time I get a chance to talk about it, because that our estimate is that about $32 million of rent has gone unpaid and people are in it are having trouble keeping it, will have trouble picking that up. And that debt is being carried almost entirely it's by the tenants, and it's also being carried by the landlords. And we're all in this together. That problem, that $32 million, absolutely overwhelms all of the federal funding, all of the local funding to prevent these kind of problems. And so we're all in this together. And so if we all work within our rights and within the law, and we hold accountable people that are acting in bad faith, whether they're tenants or landlords, then we can really get to a place where we can work together. And we've seen it. There's kind of the silver lining of this is people coming together, whether it's providers, the Justice for All initiative, bringing together legal service providers, or the systems integration process that's been led by United Way, and the way that they've brought together providers like CFC and Community Place of Greater Rochester to build these more resilient systems to help serve people. We've also seen landlords stepping up to give their tenants a break on rent. So we've seen across the board people acting in good faith to try to help meet this need and to meet the challenge of this crisis. And that's really been wonderful to see. But obviously, on the other side of it, you see people acting in bad faith, too. And I think that's the piece that we need to work to hold folks accountable to.
Okay. And Tina Foster, let's talk about how this eviction process works then. Why don't you detail the process, especially because it's important, I think, for everyone who's renting to know their own rights.
Well, I would actually defer to Mark to talk about the specifics of the process. He's a landlord-tenant court every day, but I would like to comment on more on the on sort of the changes that we're trying to make, but maybe Mark could walk us through.
All right, why don't we start there with Mark, yeah, and then we're going to walk through some of these changes. Go ahead, Mark.
Oh, sure, no problem. So if somebody falls behind on rent and they don't pay rent on the first of the month, and this is in normal times, and then I can give what's going on now, is that if that's effective.
Sure.
If someone doesn't pay rent on the 1st of August, by the 5th of August, a landlord can give what's called a 14-day notice. That's does not involve the court at that point, but somebody has 14 days to either leave the property, and then no court case would be filed, or to pay the rent that's due. After the 14-day notice expires, the landlord has the opportunity to go to court and file a notice of petition and petition. Once that notice of petition is and petition are filed, they're given a court date. And the petition has to be served on the tenant in the manner outlined in the real property actions proceedings law, sorry. But that it gets very complicated very fast. So somebody needs to receive the papers either in person or by substituted service, and they need to get at least 10 days notice before their court date. On the day of court, hopefully somebody would be represented either by my office or another attorney, and would be able to outline what's going on in their case. Maybe they have a defense. Maybe there's something else going on that we need to work out. And a lot of times, most cases work out as an agreement to pay rent over time, that somebody would move out at a certain point in time, that they would use their tax return to pay off the remainder of the rent that's owed, you know, come February or March. There are other cases where there's contentions back and forth, and we have to have a trial or we have to work it out in some other way. So after that time, so we've 14-day notice, service of court paperwork, we're at court. After the judge makes a decision or an agreement is reached, if there's a 14-day window between when a warrant is issued and when somebody can be forcibly removed by the marshal or by the sheriff from the property. So if we add all those dates together or all those numbers together, we're looking at between 50 and 60 days from the actual time of default until the end of the process. And I might have missed some time in there, but you can seek a 14-day adjournment. You can get time for a trial, and that adds another 14 days in there. So that got a little complicated, but we're looking at about 50 days to 60 days between when you default on rent to when you can be physically put out of the property.
All right. So, Mark, before the program began, you and I talked a little bit about what you have been seeing, again, not just in the pandemic, but, you know, going back to right before the pandemic, concerns about maybe disputes between tenants and landlords. I mean, sometimes even cases where someone is locked out of a property. What's the recourse if someone is the locks are literally changed? I mean, I think that's what Emily Benfer is writing, that a lot of people are going to be facing sometime, perhaps soon enough. And I know the process you just outlined is pretty specific about what's supposed to happen. But take me through, you know, what happens if the locks change, if someone is moving your stuff?
Yeah.
What do you do with that? I mean, and are you starting to see that?
So June of 2019, new laws were passed in New York State surrounding landlord-tenant relationships, and it changed the punishments and the reasons that somebody could be punished for unlawfully locking out someone from a property. So it turned what used to be a violation into a misdemeanor, which can be punishable at most. It's a Class A misdemeanor, can be punished up to 1 year in jail and some amount of a fine. It's there's a wide range of what the fine can be. It's up to $10,000 per occurrence of a violation of this specific law. So if someone comes home and they try to walk in their door but can't get in because the locks have been changed and they haven't been provided a key, whoever did that action and didn't provide them the key has committed a misdemeanor, at least on its face, and they're not immediately convicted. Obviously, they'd have to have a trial, but they're suspected of committing that crime, and the tenants should call the police. A lot of police officers have been trained in this. I know it's only, you know, it's been a year, but things started coming out in the winter time. I heard from some police officers that they've been trained on this issue. In May, the Attorney General of New York State, Tish James, put out guidance for law enforcement officers about how to treat situations like this. It's 4 or 5 pages long. It has examples. So when a police officer shows up, hopefully, in the best case, the landlord would also be there still. But that's not often the case. A lot of times people leave. Many times properties are owned by limited liability companies, mm-hmm. so it's hard to find exactly who did what. In my opinion, that's what police officers are for, to investigate crimes like this. A tenant who's been locked out in that manner that I outlined has every right to go back into the property. Now, they're not allowed to do damage or destruction to the property, and they probably wouldn't want to if they want to continue to live there. But they can get themselves back in the property. They can hire a locksmith to pick the lock. They can change the locks themselves, because it is their property to possess at that point. They don't own it, but it's under their possession. So they can get themselves back in. And if the police don't want to help them, then I would suggest they call a locksmith, and then they can call my office, and we can represent them in that case, because it's probably going to happen again if they do this self-help to get themselves back in. After that, I can file a case with city court and make sure that there's an order that maintains possession for that tenant. And then hopefully the criminal justice system would take the reins if there's enough evidence of what's going on.
Okay. And Mark, how do they get a hold of you and those who can help?
Oh, sure. The Legal Aid Society is 232-4090. Illegal lockouts are treated as emergencies. They come right to our staff to do a quick intake, and then are assigned to an attorney, usually within that day, if not the next day.
So we treat those very seriously, and they come through basically as soon as possible.
Well, and for listeners who maybe are doubting that we're on the cusp of seeing a much bigger wave of this kind of lockout situation, let me go ahead and read this story that I think Emily Benfer linked to this one, and I'm reading it from the real estate news site, therealdeal.com. I'm wondering, you know, Emily, I'm going to read this. I'm going to ask you how common you think this might become. Quote, responding to an eviction in process in South Central Los Angeles, tenant organizers did not call a defense attorney. They called a contractor who came equipped with a power drill. When a local landlord removed a resident's belongings and changed the locks on his apartment a week after he missed rent, Paul Langtod, an organizer with the Los Angeles Tenant Union, said he put out a call to a network of supporters, and soon after, more than 30 tenant organizers arrived at the home and physically blocked a moving van loaded with the tenant's belongings. While some linked arms to keep the van from pulling out of the driveway, others formed a blockade around the back entry to the apartment building where the contractor got to work. In just 5 minutes, he removed the lock and opened the door, and organizers rapidly moved the belongings back in. The building's landlord told The Real Deal he was overwhelmed by the group's response. When the tenant stopped paying rent, the landlord said he tried to move him to a cheaper property, but those efforts led to the sudden backlash, which the landlord characterized as a riot. In the end, the tenant stayed put, end quote. Emily Benfer, how often do you think we're going to see this kind of scenario?
I think that story is really indicative of just the level of desperation we're seeing across the country, that people are trying so hard to keep a roof over their head during a pandemic, which when we're being told to stay home for our safety, I can't imagine anything more terrifying than having no place to call home. So that example is a really good one of tenant unions and tenant organizing across the country. The eviction system itself, the process, is very inequitable. 90% of tenants are unrepresented in hearings, despite the attorneys that are on this call. For every tenant who needs them, there are not enough attorneys to represent them, whereas 10% of landlords are unrepresented in those cases. So tenant unions are forming across the country in this effort to shift the bargaining power, to infuse the system with more equity and balance. And that's what we're seeing here with this type of organizing, too. And it's also, it reminds me of the turn of the century when we really didn't have eviction, mm-hmm. where tenants would actually organize. And when their property was being removed from the building, the tenants would move it right back in to prevent that eviction from happening. So we're in a very different situation today. And in this pandemic environment, anything we can do to try to keep people housed and safe without passing the burden on to the landlord is really critical. Eviction is a jagged downhill slide. There is no ladder back up, and it has severe consequences for health, well-being, educational attainment, and it actually is proven to result in unemployment. So at a time when we're trying to rebuild the economy, we have to try and prevent eviction from happening.
Let's do this. Let's take our only break of the hour, and we've got listener feedback, and then I'm gonna ask some of our guests, Tina Foster, Alex Turner, to tell us, Mark Moyo, to tell us again more about what's happening locally to address this kind of budding crisis here. Maybe you've seen city newspaper reporting on this or heard James Brown from WXXI News. It is an issue here. I don't say that as an advocate, and I know some listeners are sort of always on guard for the bias they see. We're trying to show empathy to everybody involved here, and yes, to landlords. I mean, to people who own property. This is a hard spot, especially in a pandemic with millions of people out of work, many people already struggling coming into this pandemic. And now the question of how do you pay rent for landlords? How do you pay a mortgage? And what happens next year? But the point Emily Benfer is making there is not based on advocacy. That's just reality. If we see a rash of evictions across Rochester, Western New York, and the country, what do you think is going to happen to this economy? That's not me advocating what to do about it. I let others do that. But we are facing a real, real turning point, especially with the $600 a week running out. Don't know if that's going to be extended. With a lot of landlords saying no more breaks. And things are really, really starting to shift as we go into the fall. So let's take that only break, and we will come right back with our guests for the hour, including Emily Benfer, who is a visiting associate clinical professor of law at Columbia Law School and wrote that piece for NBCNews.com we've been quoting from. Mark Moyo is here from the Legal Aid Society of Rochester. Tina Foster, executive director of the Volunteer Legal Services Project in Monroe County. Alex Turner, an eviction prevention representative to the Homeless Services Network and a community resource services program director at Catholic Family Center. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about the safety of going back to school, going back to work this fall. Now, we're going to talk to teachers next week, and there's a lot of concern about whether teachers are safe. But what about other frontline workers, those who work in those buildings, in those schools, in those offices? Their perspective next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. After our guests kind of outline what is happening in terms of a possible eviction crisis and what they think should happen, I'm going to turn it over to your feedback for the rest of the hour. But let's start with this. Tina Foster, what is happening right now you want listeners to be aware of, and what do you think should be happening?
So what is happening right now is, I think, a massive effort to educate the public, to prepare for the onslaught of legal evictions. But I think the most important thing for people to know right now is that unless you have a court-ordered eviction, you don't have to leave. As the point, as the other folks mentioned, there are tenants' rights groups that are organizing around this because of the lack of legal protections that have been provided. But more importantly, I think we're looking at some structural issues. I think there are some important shifts in how we how we treat this issue locally. And one of the important shifts is exactly what Emily was talking about with respect to the number of people that actually have a voice in the system and are represented in the legal system. Less than 10% of people in this county are represented by an attorney in an eviction proceeding. More than 90% of landlords are. So we have a situation where people don't believe in the legal system as being equitable for everybody. And so in Rochester, when someone is threatened with, I may evict you, they're likely to leave without any legal process. There's an imbalance of power. There's a way that things have been going on. And there's also a stigma with being evicted. People don't want that to be known to their community members and other people. And so I think there's a cultural problem and a shift that we need to look at in terms of structurally how we are apportioning power in this community. The other piece that I will say is, why should it be that tenants have to organize to do the job that is really of the police? And we see right now that tenants in these areas, as well as landlords in these areas that are also people of color, are not served well by the police oftentimes in these areas, and that causes more racial tensions. And so I think one of the important things would be to have law enforcement engage with us in this process, because we have at the table the courts, we have, we have all the legal service providers, we have city council folks, we have county folks. We need law enforcement to join with us in helping to keep everybody safe, make sure that the laws and policies are in place. And also, to your point on the landlords, I will add that the landlord's bar is highly in favor of the proposals that we've made in terms of increasing representation for people, ensuring that the laws are enforced and that the protections are there. We're working on a plan to make sure that people get counsel earlier in the process, so that settlements can be reached. We don't have to have necessarily an adversarial conversation every single time. There are settlements that can be reached with resources such as rental assistance. Most landlords do not want to evict people. They just want to be paid the rent. And, I think that's a fair part of the bargain, and we need to give them resources in order to get that. But in terms of tenant representation and tenant advocacy, that makes the system better for everybody, including landlords, because landlords are more likely to get paid when we have everybody represented in the system.
All right. Alex Turner, what's happening? What should happen?
So I can talk to what's happening. I was really hoping I could give lots of practical details about our program today, but
sure.
We've been throwing a couple curveballs from our funders at HUD, and we're still trying to work out exactly what the eligibility requirements are. So what I will do is I'll say that if you want the most up-to-date information about our program, we have a pretty simple website, which is emergencyrentrockroc.org. And so if you go there, that'll have a lot of information about how folks can apply. and where who to call and what to do. And that will evolve over the course of the next couple months as the systems integration program gets up and running. So there's lots of providers working together to get as much emergency rent assistance out into the community as quickly as possible. That is absolutely our top priority. And there will be wait times on all those services and different things that are coming up. But I think that the most important thing is for us to all be in this together. I mean, just for tenants and landlords to have transparent negotiations about this is what I have, this is what I can give you, this is when I will have it. All of those kind of transparent negotiations and everyone being as resourceful as they can working together, that's ultimately what's going to get us through this. Because those 20 or even 30,000 households, all of our services put together will be able to serve some portion of that. And we just need to make sure that we're all thinking about how do we all work through this together. And I think kind of what you mentioned about the vilifying one group or the other is counterproductive. We all really do have to work at this together, whether it's providers, tenants, landlords, all of us, to get through this. Because the impact and the ripple effects on our local community, the community members who do end up getting evicted, all of that. I just can't stress enough how important it is for us to be patient and give grace everywhere we can with one another.
Mark Moyo, you told City Newspaper that what City Council is looking at is creating something that kind of takes the form of a public defender, allocating money so your office can provide access to counsel for anyone facing eviction in the city of Rochester who wants representation. How significant is that, and how imminent is that now?
I'll take the second question first. The vote is on August 18th.
August 18th, right, yeah.
Yep. So that's when the money will be, I think, officially allocated. It's something that we've been working on for a number of years, and that's what Tina mentioned, that there's a group that's been convening in all sorts of different areas of the law, but housing was one specific one. And so we had a plan that was out there and a budget that we had created amongst the legal services providers. Our goal is to provide legal representation to people facing eviction in the city of Rochester and either some of the towns in the county or all. We're still working on that end of it. But yes, this money coming from the city of Rochester is huge in terms of getting us off the ground and being able to tell other funders, yes, we have this funding, and with it we can start representing folks. We can hire more attorneys. To Emily's point, yes, I've been going to court for a long time, but with the speed that things are expected to go and the number of attorneys we have there, it's just not possible to represent everybody. And so I think it is a form of a public defender. I don't want to sit here and say that some new right has been created, but it's our goal to be at court every day to represent as many people as who are seeking counsel in their case.
Okay. And Emily Benfer, when you talk about the federal opportunity to provide relief, are there specifics that you want listeners to be aware of, or is it generally just the idea that the branch of government with the most power in this case is the one that doesn't have necessarily limitations on what it can immediately do in terms of budget concerns?
Well, the issue is that local and state governments have already depleted the funds that they have.
Mm-hmm.
Across the country, where they have diverted CARES Act funding through the Community Development Block Grant for rental assistance, it has been completely depleted within minutes, 90 minutes to a business day. So the federal government must provide public funds for rental assistance to ensure that renters stay housed and that property owners can continue to maintain their property and pay property taxes and their mortgage. In addition, we need to couple that with a nationwide uniform moratorium on eviction to prevent any misunderstanding of rights and any abuse of that system. Ultimately, we do need to address the root causes of the eviction crisis and the lack of affordable housing in our country. But in the meantime, we can also try to make the system more equitable by adding community-based diversion programs for people facing eviction, by adding a legal right to counsel in eviction cases to decrease the outcome of that and ensure that people stay housed through this pandemic. I've represented
many tenants in eviction cases, and I've been present for evictions. And I want to emphasize that this is really affecting families, that the single greatest predictor of an eviction is the presence of a child. And more families will find notices of eviction tacked to their door, and sheriffs will forcibly remove them from their homes and their communities. And children across the country will watch as their beds and their toys are piled up on the curb or locked up in storage, and they'll have to pay a large fee to get it back. So this is an emotional trauma. And on top of that, it leaves that physical wreckage, family photographs. I've seen unmatched shoes on the sidewalk, childhood books. That this is something that we're going to be putting millions of children and adults through if we don't intervene as quickly and with speed and meaningful intervention as possible. And that truly is, I think, the only way we prevent the long-term impact of this on all members of our community.
Let me get some feedback from listeners. Allie in Rochester on the phone first. Go ahead, Allie.
Hi, everyone. This is Allie from the Citywide Tenant Union of Rochester. I just want to go over some of the demands that we have as a statewide coalition, but then a local coalition. It's kind of interesting. No one has talked about a full cancellation of rent and mortgages. The reality being is that we are bailing out bad landlords when we have all of the subsidies, but we have a limited amount of subsidies, as you guys have all pointed out, and that means that we're not putting funds towards other things like childcare and healthcare and small businesses. And the reality being is if we just cancel rent and mortgages, it's going to be a huge win on both sides. In addition, we have some local platforms. I love, you know, that Mark and others have taken the lead on expanding the right to counsel, but let's just be clear. We're just expanding the right to counsel, assuming council passes this, that we're not actually guaranteeing it as a right to tenants. In addition, the loophole without good cause eviction protections is that landlords just don't have to renew leases if people fall a little bit behind and maybe they get caught back up. And we're seeing that again and again and again. I talk to people every single week who are getting notices that their leases aren't being renewed. And it's terrifying for people because there's nowhere to go. We have a huge affordable housing crisis, as people have hit on. And Evan, I love that story that you shared earlier and the desperation that you're seeing of tenants and tenant advocates all around the nation. And I'm here to tell everybody that the Rochester Housing Justice Alliance has been formed, and we are prepared to physically stop evictions. We've trained over 100 people in how to do this. We are having a kickoff event tonight at 5:00 outside the courthouse. We invite anybody who is struggling to pay rent to join us, anybody who believes that people matter more than profit and property to join us. And that's all I've got, and I'm sure there's some great responses from your guests.
Okay, I'll let Alex Turner start. Go ahead, Allie. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, absolutely. I really applaud the efforts of local activists, especially to resist these illegal evictions, that it's when landlords are acting in bad faith to hold them accountable and make sure that folks can keep their homes. I think that those efforts are really wonderful. And I'll be honest, in terms of policies around cancellation of rent, ultimately that would be a terrific thing. The logistics of it, those are the kinds of things that local program folks like me might not be able to figure out. And so in terms of what we can do locally and what's in our control, those are the kinds of things that we just don't necessarily have answers for. But I appreciate the activism to protect people's right to stay in their housing when they're illegally evicted. And we're going to do everything we can to help tenants to catch up on rent when there is that gap with the funds that we do have.
Okay, Mark Moyo.
Yeah, I appreciate a lot of what Allie had to say. Regarding the difference between access to counsel and a right to counsel is important, but I wonder if we ask some people accused of crimes in Louisiana whether they have a right to counsel under Gideon versus Wainwright. So I support civil Gideon here in New York State. I would love for that to happen, but on top of that, we also need funding and access to counsel. They kind of go hand in hand. So this is a pilot project. We're hoping to prove our concept that attorneys for tenants will pay for themselves, in essence, or even make money year over year, where DHS doesn't have to make payments to landlords because we found other sources of funding, or a landlord is asking for the wrong months of rent, or fill in the blank in terms of
having people be put in shelters and how the expense of that and the cost of that over many years to the children and to the people who are housed in shelters. So we're trying to prove our concept that access to counsel, that representation in landlord-tenant court is going to be an effective money saver for the municipality on top of being what I consider to be the humane thing to do to make sure that people are apprised of their rights in court and that they get a full and fair hearing if that's what's necessary in their case.
All right. Real briefly, I'm trying to squeeze in a lot of feedback here. A listener wants a guest to define the idea of canceling rent. Does that mean rent not paid during the pandemic or going forward? Alex Turner, is there an answer for that one?
I'll be honest that I haven't seen a lot of details around the policies of canceling rent. I know that there has been, I really don't understand how we could cancel rent without making the landlords whole, to be honest, because they are providing a service of maintained and quality housing and the landlords that are acting in good faith. So the idea of just canceling it, I don't know the definition, I guess, is my answer.
Okay.
Emily might have more details.
Yeah, Emily Manfer?
It depends on which jurisdiction you're in. Some cancel the rent movements are wiping out the slate, so starting over after the pandemic, and others, like there's a bill in Congress that was introduced that it's called cancel the rent, and so it would wipe out past debt, but it also includes funding to pay for that debt as well. So it's shifting the burden onto the government as opposed to the property owner.
Okay. Let me get Tim in Bloomfield on the phone next. Go ahead, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a landlord, and I would like to think I'm a pretty decent landlord, but I believe the reason that more landlords are represented in court than tenants are is because it's extremely difficult for a landlord on his own to go through the court system and prove all the documentation necessary to legally evict a tenant, as well as if you are a limited liability company, you're excluded from going to small claims court or your local town court. Now you have to go to the state's Supreme Court because of your limited liability status. So, you know, there's a big reason why landlords come with attorneys. It's because we almost have to in order to pacify or satisfy the legal requirements in an action like that. And I thought I'd throw that out there. Love your show. Love your panelists. Thank you for taking my call.
All right, Tim, thank you. Mark Moyle, you want to start with a response there?
Oh, sure. So starting in June 2019, things did get a little bit more complicated. That's absolutely true. And at that point, I believe, you know, it's my understanding from the practitioners on the landlord side that they started getting more business because rules changed. Things got a little bit more extensive in terms of paperwork. And they wanted to make sure that because of those long timelines that I outlined at the beginning of this show, that they weren't going to get dismissed in court after waiting for some period of time, maybe 30 days before they got into court, and then lose because they made some sort of a paperwork mistake. Before that, and even now, I know I'm a lawyer, but it is not super duper difficult to file your own paperwork and to do that on your own. Some of my family members filed their own paperwork, and I've seen a lot of pro se landlords still over at court. It does take a little bit of research, and Tim is correct regarding LLCs. They do need to be represented because they've chosen the corporate form, and there's no individual who's not an attorney who can represent them because they're legal fiction. So they do need to have an attorney. That's absolutely true.
So as we're down to our last 90 seconds or so, let me just ask Tina Foster real briefly, share with listeners, again, resources you want people to be aware of or final thoughts as we kind of wrap this discussion on a possible crisis of evictions to come here. What do you want people to know, Tina?
If you are in an illegal eviction situation where you're being locked out, please call the resources. I think it's Legal Aid Society is one of the places you can call. Mark will give the number again, hopefully.
Yep.
I know that Catholic Family Center is also, hopefully it will give the website and phone number where you can get rental assistance. There are many, many agencies all over. These are just a couple. I would say that there is a massive undertaking between landlords of good faith, like your caller just now, tenants, and many other people in the community, it's time to get involved. If you're interested in this issue specifically or working as part of the Justice for All initiative, you can contact VLSP, which is my organization. Happy to give you my email, which is tfoster@vlsprochester.org. Feel free to email me if you would like to be more involved in this effort.
Mark Moya, the phone number for legal aid.
232-4090, the Legal Aid Society of Rochester.
232-4090. Alex Turner, how to get in touch with you if need be.
So emergencyrentrock.org, emergencyrentrock.org.
And let me also thank Emily Benfer for her time. Emily, updating her background and title, joining us from the Wake Forest University School of Law. And I want to thank all of our guests. Emily, thank you for making the time for this program and bringing that national perspective. We appreciate it very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tina Foster, Mark Moyo, Alex Turner, thank you for your perspectives as well. And let's please stay in touch as we see what happens in this community, across Western New York, across this country. Thanks to all of you for weighing in, and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
More connections coming up.